It's so unusual for us to think that love is somehow different today. It is different in the sense that we express it electronically, but I do believe that people want to express love in old-fashioned ways.
I think dating is a kind of theater in which we try on and rehearse different roles, and it can feel like a very experimental form of theater.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square. Tonight we've assembled a truly eclectic array of guests to address the complex subject of romance in the information age. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we're delighted to have two speakers, one actor and three musicians, all to help us unravel some of the mysteries of modern romance. Friendships and love affairs were once the glorious domain of pen and paper, where lovers poured forth their souls. We wrote, kept, and treasured love letters. Now they have become mere electronic transactions, executed and terminated in a few tapped texts. Tonight we are going to consider what we have lost and what we have gained through digital intimacy. And first I'll introduce our guests. Kurt DiCamillo is the curator of special collections at the New England Historical Genealogical Society. Maura Weigel is postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University and author of Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating. Johnny Lee Davenport is an actor extraordinaire, and we have three fine blues musicians, Lenny Peterson, Mark Campbell, and Tim Paul. So first, we're going to begin with art historian Kurt DiCamillo, who has brought with him some artifacts as a way of explaining why, historically, we've always written and treasured love letters. Is this practice over? Over to you, Kurt.
I have to say, I don't think that love has actually changed that much. I think humanity has remained unchanged, and therefore love is unchanged. How we express it is all that's really changed. Unfortunately, for those of you in the audience, you can't see these things too well, but what I have here are things that I've taken from the collection of the New England Historic Genealogical Society, and they all involve hair, which, believe it or not, was a way to express your love. This, for instance, is a hair bracelet. This is all hair, sort of creepy. Here, very deceivingly, is a cameo. On one side and on the other, in the back, is a lock of hair. And then lastly, this is a brooch that has a rock crystal facing with two different colors of hair, which probably indicates that the two lovers are having their hair entwined. Something that we probably don't realize today is that this was the highest sort of evidence of love, was to give somebody a bit of your hair. And most interestingly to me is that hair is sort of like Dorian Gray. When you cut it, it stopped aging. So you have somebody who's in their 80s and dying, has white hair, and they can look back to a locket that their mother gave them when they were five that has bright red hair in it. And that's what's most amazing today, is this hair is unchanged in the color it was when it was first given. I think these kinds of things have sort of fallen out, but there are other things as well. I don't have any in our collections, but I brought with me a book on eye jewelry. This is actually something that really only existed for about 20, 30 years in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. What I'm holding up here is an eye painted in ivory, surrounded by garnets. Almost exclusively, this was done with one eye because you were meant to keep your lover's secret. If you did both eyes, you could probably identify who they were. You didn't want that. You wanted to keep it a secret. Oftentimes because of illicit love affairs. We do know that this whole pattern was something that was started in England by the Prince Regent, later King George IV, who was having affairs all the time and didn't want anybody to know who he was having an affair with. So he married a number of times clandestinely and exchanged eyes painted in ivory with his lovers. And I think that's an amazing way to think of things. This is meant to be a secret love. The eye that only you would know and the two of you would come together, or with this hair that we have here. Something, as I say, I think we think of today as being sort of creepy, but in fact, it's not creepy at all. It's something that's a part of you that will forever remain at the time you cut it. But I think most of us, when we think about hair, we think about love. Of course, love is hair. Think about love letters. And I was very lucky that the archives where I work at the New England Historic Genealogical Society very kindly, on one day's notice, came up with a letter, a love letter for me, dated December 18th, 1844, from a man named Ira Smith, who was a student at the Yale Seminary, writing to his sweetheart, Sarah Bartholomew, and it's three pages, of which I will only give you the first sentence because I found it rather sweet. He said, "I'm almost sick tonight, entirely unfit for study. I can do nothing but sit alone in my room and think of you." Now, what's interesting about this, we have 3 years of their correspondence. This one's dated, as I said, December 18th, 1844. We have 5 years of courting. It's almost very, very unlikely they ever would have had sex until they got married, and they did get married in 1846. But I love this, how he signs this letter, "From your sincere and ardent lover, I. H. Smith." The fact that he would use that sign-off when he had probably never even kissed her, but yet attach with it his formal name at the same time. What's interesting about this, if we trace their letters, is that he felt he was unworthy of being a priest going into the calling. He graduated from Yale Seminary, then married his wife, and they moved to Topeka, Kansas, just before the Civil War, where he became first a miner and then a farmer, which is something you would not expect somebody growing up and going to school in New Haven and Yale to do. And I think this is something that's so important too. I would almost guarantee you that they exchanged hair at some point, something I think we have to bring back into the lexicon, hair exchange. It's so unusual for us to think that love is somehow different today. It is different in the sense that we express it electronically, but I do believe that people want to express love in old-fashioned ways. I was saying to this young lady earlier that there was an article I read in the New York Times about a 20-something who wrote about her desire to get away from an electronic calendar and have paper, and the sensualness of paper and writing things down on paper and the quality of the paper. And I think that's the same thing with love, and that's why I did receive a Valentine. This is the Valentine I received yesterday at work. I love anything that sparkles, and it has a very small inscription in the back. But I think this kind of stuff, something that's tactile, that we can touch, means so much more than a text. I'm embarrassed to say that I did send Valentines, but they were all texts or emails. I am embarrassed because I love this sort of thing, but I didn't take the time to do it. And I think that's what it comes down to. Love hasn't changed. The way we express it really hasn't changed. It's just, will we give ourselves the time to say it's worth it to buy a card, sit down, address the envelope, put a stamp on it, walk to the mailbox and mail it? Because that's what people don't do anymore. Electronic communication makes it too easy. And that's why I think when someone does receive a letter, it has so much more impact than when I was growing up, because then that was the only way to communicate. And now this answers, I think, a part of the human soul. We want to feel appreciated in something tangible. And showing someone a text or a photograph on your phone sent from your boyfriend or girlfriend isn't the same as saying, look at this. And in this case, it sparkles.
Okay. It sparkles. So now we're going to bring the discussion up to the present day with Dr. Maura Ugel, who is on the cutting edge, really, of studying the latest trends in dating and algorithmic intimacy. In the book Labor of Love, The Invention of Dating, she says, "Dating is a precarious form of contemporary labor, an unpaid internship. You cannot be sure where things are heading. But you try to gain experience, and if you look sharp, you might get a free lunch." So, have reports of the death of dating been greatly exaggerated? I'm going to turn things over to you, Maura.
I am. So I love beginning this with this question, has the death of dating, have reports of the death of dating been greatly exaggerated? And I would say that my answer to that question, the simple answer, is yes, the reports have been exaggerated. And the slightly more complicated answer would start with a question, which is, what is dating? How would we define it? So I think this question, what is dating, is actually a harder question to answer than one might immediately think. And what's interesting when we think about both contemporary life and social history is that it usually gets articulated, this definition, in moments of crisis. So you're much more likely to read an article saying, young people aren't dating anymore, or, you know, we're living in the age of a Tinderpocalypse, or, you know, love is dead, than an article articulating, here's what we think love should be, or perhaps more to the point, here's how we believe gender roles should be. I think that dating My interest in dating started not because I'd been obsessed with romance, although I, like anyone, enjoy talking about sex and romance, but because I think dating is a kind of theater in which we try on and rehearse different roles, and it can feel like a very experimental form of theater in the present day. But I think that these conversations, I mean, surely, folks, if you read mainstream magazines or blogs or newspapers, you from time to time see these articles. I feel like there was a real spate of them around 2013, 2014 when I started thinking about this topic. But these articles that say, you know, kids are going out on their cell phones, they're not, men aren't taking women out on dates anymore, expressing these kinds of anxieties. And what's interesting to me is what those articles suggest. I think a lot of the source of their appeal is actually this often quite, in my view, sort of regressive notion about how men are supposed to be, how women are supposed to be, how heterosexuality is supposed to be. So I think that's enough by way of preliminary remarks, and I'll jump right into reading this essay about what I call sexual freelancing in the gig economy. A friend of mine complains about how many of the men she meets on Tinder use corporate language to chatter up. First, they reach out. Then, after spending the night together, they follow up. This kind of flirting is banal, but it makes sense. We constantly use economic metaphors to describe our romantic and sexual relations. Few people today refer to women as, quote, damaged goods, I hope, or wonder why a man would, quote, buy the cow when he can get the milk for free. My friend's mom had the riposte to that, which was why buy the pig when you could have the sausage for free, which I liked as a kind of equal opportunity disgusting metaphor, once again, for heterosexuality. Anyway, why would you buy the cow when you can get the milk for free? But we do have friends with benefits, and we, quote, invest in relationships. An ex may be on or off the market. Online dating makes shopping around explicit. Blog after blog strategizes about how to maximize your ROI, return on investment, on OkCupid. We use this kind of language because the ways that people date, who contacts whom, where they meet, and what happens next, have always been tied to the economy. Dating applies the logic of capitalism to courtship. On the dating market, everyone competes for him or herself. When parents worry about how their 20-something kids are or aren't pairing off, or the authors of trend pieces lament the death of courtship, they seem to forget that the pursuit of sex and romance didn't remain unchanged from the moment when the first Homo sapiens sidled across the savanna towards his soulmate until Steve Jobs rolled out his iPhone. If you want to understand why Netflix and chill has replaced dinner in a movie, you need to look at how people work. Today, people are constantly told that we must be flexible and adaptable in order to succeed. Is it surprising that these values are reshaping how many of us approach sex and love? Back when most people punch clocks at fixed hours, a date might have asked, "Shall I pick you up at 6?" But part-timers, contractors, and other contingent workers who constitute some 40% of the American workforce are more inclined to text one another, "You still up?" than to make plans in advance. Smartphones have altered expectations about when we are on and off, and working from home or from cafes has blurred the lines between labor and leisure. My dad, by the way, read this essay and he now texts me, "You up?" because he totally misunderstood the point of that text. He texted me that at 9:30 a.m. yesterday. I was like, "Yeah, Dad, I'm awake." The average American may not be asking someone out on a date today because he works longer hours than he used to. The 2013 and 2014 work and education poll conducted by Gallup found that the average full-time American worker reported working 47 hours per week. Moreover, 21% of the people surveyed reported working 50 to 59 hours per week. Another 18% said they worked 60 hours or more per week. So 50% more hours than pick you up at 6 era. And those are just hours on the clock. They don't include the time spent outside normal hours answering emails or maintaining a winning social media presence, activities that many jobs require. follow me on Twitter. In other words, single people today tend to work longer hours than they would have in the Norman Rockwell soda fountain era that many people seem to have in mind when they get misty-eyed about traditional dating. No surprise that they have less time and energy left, however, to go out. In most times and places, matchmaking rituals have been designed to lead to marriage and reproduction. In the case of dating, the goals of your endeavor are less clear. Many single Americans hope to find more than someone to binge watch Breaking Bad and have sex with. 53% of never married Americans still say they want to get married someday. But marriage rates have declined significantly since 1960. The median age of first marriage has risen to a record high. It's 27 for women and 29 for men. Sometimes social class can make a difference. Growing numbers of working class Americans are eschewing marriage and having children outside of marriage. In a 2013 study conducted by researchers at Harvard and the University of Virginia, working class respondents cited low wages and a lack of job security as the primary reason for these changes. But a high average salary doesn't necessarily mean stable relationships. A 2013 report called Not Yet, The Benefits and Costs of Delayed Marriage in America, observed that young adults have gone from seeing marriage as a, quote, cornerstone of adult life to its capstone, something you enter only after you complete your education and attain professional stability. Until then, you may be better off swiping through Tinder. Still, and here's where I get to the positive part, still, for all the challenges, it's worth noting that the gig economy has also brought some much-needed flexibility to dating and relationships. Young women today face less pressure to build their lives around marriage and childbearing than their mothers and grandmothers did. If you are gay or lesbian, or if you want a relationship that is not monogamous, you are likely to meet less resistance than you might have in the past. Still, as the work of dating has become increasingly flexible, it has also become increasingly precarious. So sound familiar from current events. Dating itself is a recent invention. It developed when young people began moving to cities and women began working outside private homes, and that's a big part of the point of my book. The History of Dating is a Feminist History, intimately tied to women entering the workforce. By 1900, 44% of single American women worked. 44%. Previously, courtship had taken place under adult supervision in private places, a parlor, a factory dance, or a church social. But once women started going out and earning wages, they had more freedom over where and how they met prospective mates. And because men vastly out-earned women, they typically paid for entertainment. People are always asking me, should you let a man pay on a date? And I say, it's just wage redistribution until we get better than that 77 cents on the dollar. 64 cents for African-American women and 56 for Latina, I think. So that assuages guilt at letting men pay. Today we refer to a man inviting a woman to dinner as traditional. At first, it was scandalous. A woman who arranged to meet a man at a bar or restaurant could find herself being interrogated by a vice commission. True story. In the 1920s and 30s, as more and more middle-class women started going to college, parents and faculty panicked over what they called rating and dating culture, which led kids to participate in petting parties and to take joyrides with members of the opposite sex. By the 1950s, a new kind of dating took over, going steady. Popular advice columnist Dorothy Dix, who was then the most widely syndicated female writer in America, warned in 1939 that going steady was, quote, insane folly. But by the post-war era of full employment, this form of courtship made perfect sense. The booming economy, which was targeting the newly flush teen demographic, dictated that in order for everyone to partake in new consumer pleasures, for everyone to go out for a burger or root beer float on weekends, young people had to pair off. Today, the economy is transforming courtship yet again. But the changes aren't only practical. The economy shapes our feelings and values as well as our behaviors. The generation of Americans that came of age around the time of the 2008 financial crisis have been told constantly that we must be flexible and adaptable. Is it so surprising that we have turned into sexual freelancers? Many of us treat relationships like unpaid internships. We cannot expect them to lead to anything long term, so we use them to get experience. If we look sharp, we might get a free lunch, as Mary said. But for all the hand-wringing, this kind of dating isn't any more transactional than it was back when suitors paid women family-supervised visits or parents sought out a yenta to introduce their children at a synagogue mixer. Courtship has always been dictated by changes in the market. The good news is that dating is not the exact same thing as love, and as anyone who has ever been in love can attest, the laws of supply and demand do not control our feelings. Thanks.
Well, there's a lot of statistics to absorb there. So now we get to the fun part before we have our own discussion and questions. We're going to invite the artists up because they're going to express the things that some of us can't say. So.
This is Sonnet 29. When in disgrace with fortune and in men's eyes, I, all alone, beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look at myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, having this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy, contented least, desiring that man's art and that man's scope. Yet, in these thoughts, myself almost despising, haply I think on thee, and then my state, like to the lark at break of day, arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate, for thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings. But then I scorn to change my state with kings. By Daniel Hoffman. I am yours as the summer air at evening is possessed by the scent of linden blossoms. As the snow cap gleams with light, lent it by the brimming moon. Without you, I'd be an unleafed tree, blasted in a bleakness with no spring. Your love is the weather of my being, what is an island without the sea?
That must have elicited feelings in some of you, good, bad, or indifferent. So I welcome you up to the microphone to ask any question you like.
Quick question about the kinds of technology that have intruded in a way. One of the most powerful things we heard from the artist this evening was a song which everyone started to hum and actually repeat the words of. So we went, in a sense, from the music to the film that was behind it, The Way You Look Tonight, right? To a visual thing. So we went music, film, visual, and re-envisioned a moment of very tender exchange. And in fact, ignited the notion of rather mundane experience being electric. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you thought about the way film has reinvented intimacy in a way, such that just repeating the strains on a trombone can call all of that back.
Yeah, if I could take that one for 1 second. I think that one thing that's so powerful, that's implicit in your comment and your question, and that we were all reacting to in the space tonight, is also that cinema, at least in its older incarnation, was a communal art form, and so is music, that it's a thing that happens in shared space. I think about Spotify and my iPhone, and it's like I probably listen to, I have more music at my fingertips than anyone in history, but it's private. I listen to it by myself. But the thing about the cinema is it really is, it's an art of time and of being together in a certain space and time. And I think in that sense, there's something deeply sort of like erotic and connective and interactive about it. It's also a place where American culture depicts what we think love should be or what love we should aspire to. I feel like in classic screwball comedies of the 1930s and 40s or classic rom-coms of the 1980s and 90s, it's almost philosophical, like it's almost like a platonic dialogue. It's like, can men and women be friends? Like, what if you fell in love with someone pretending to be someone else? And it creates this very democratic sphere for discussing this about like what we think love should be. But also, unignorably, the cinema is a place to go on a date. And it's both a site, an occasion to go out and do something with other people, and I think a kind of mirror and a target of aspiration. So I think that it's absolutely important, and what's changed to my mind is how much more individualized our devices are. I think what I miss in the cinema, and I don't go to the cinema nearly as often as I used to, is this experience of sharing something, as we all have tonight, together in time, and something that I can't stop when I want to, you know, go get a bowl of cereal or answer my text message or what have you. It sort of creates a shared space for the culture. I don't know. What do you think about that?
It just reminds me of it's a shared experience as humans in the same room, but it's also the sense of something that just overwhelms you. This has been written about a lot in the last 5 years, about the size of the screen and why movie stars were bigger, literally and figuratively, in the 30s and 40s than they are today.
So thanks for all coming out tonight, and we hope to see you all again soon. Thank you. You've been listening to Romance in the Information Age, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square in February 2018 with Moira Weigel, author of Labour of Love, also Kurt DiCamillo, art historian, Johnny Lee Davenport, actor, and musicians Lenny Peterson, Mark Campbell, and Tim Paul. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us.